We're doing the Inyakov, we're up to Tractate Shabbos, the second chapter, Amar Reish Lakish. Who is Reish Lakish? We're talking about Reish Lakish, Reish Lakish. Very good, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish was a Jew who learned Torah and then decided that he's had it. He left observancy, he stopped being observant, and went off to be a chief bandit. He had an army, he had his group of bandits under him. And then one time he sees Rabbi Yochanan swimming across the Jordan. And he sees Rabbi Yochanan's beauty, and he leaps across the Jordan, thinking he's going to at least rob Rabbi Yochanan. We'll assume not more than that. At least steal from Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan looks up, sees Reish Lakish, recognizes him, and says, "What strength, you such a leap, in one leap, flying leap, you cross the Jordan? If you'd only apply that strength to Torah study." And he's really telling him, "Come back." And Reish Lakish looks at him and says, "What beauty, if only your beauty would be on a woman." To which Rav Yochanan says, "I have a sister who's better looking than me. If you do tshuva, I'll convince her to marry you." And Reish Lakish says, "It's a deal." And with that, Reish Lakish re-enrolls in yeshiva. Says in the Medrash that the same day Reish Lakish died, his soldier of his henchmen died too, and they met in heaven on their way up, and he was going one direction and they were going the other, and they turned to God and said, "Wait a second, we used to do everything together, why is he going up and we're going down?" And God said, well, he chose a different path in life. So that's Reish Lakish. He really married Rav Yochanan's sister. He was Rav Yochanan's brother-in-law. Should we go through the rest of the story, or you guys all know the rest of the story? The end of Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish. You know the story? What?
It's such a sad story.
Right, it is a sad story. But if you know it, we don't have to go over it. You know it? You know it too? No. So, okay, we'll quickly go over it because it's relevant to now, to our Beina Meitzarim. The Gemara in Tractate Baba Metzia is discussing the verse that says, "Lo tonu ish et amito," do not afflict your fellow man, which is really discussing how in business you have to be fair. You have to be fair with one another. And then the Gemara says, the Torah repeats a second time, "Velo tonu ish et amito," don't afflict your fellow man. And on that, the Talmud says, the Mishnah says, from here we learn that a person cannot say something hurtful to someone else. That repetition of "don't afflict your fellow man" is to teach us that you shouldn't say something hurtful. So here we have a biblical prohibition of saying something hurtful to someone. And then the Gemara starts giving us examples of how harsh how harsh that can be. So you initially have in the Mishnah a general discussion. And then the Mishnah goes on to the idea of onah tvarim, saying something hurtful. Let's see. Somewhere over here. So we should really learn all of this, Gemara, because this is our big topic now. The idea of being careful how we speak, not to hurt someone. So let's see, where is it? On the Atevarim. Here we go. Mishnah says, "Keshem shonab mekach umimkau," just as it's prohibited to afflict someone in business, "kach onah bedvarim," so too it's prohibited to afflict someone with words. "Lo yomar lo b'kama chefet zev u'eino rotzeh likach," person shouldn't say, "How much does that cost?" when he has zero intent of buying it. He's just wasting the guy's time. "Im haya ba'al tshuva lo yomar lo zchom ma'aseich harishonim," if a person did tshuva, you don't start telling him, "Hey, remember when you used to do that?" That's wrong. "Im u'ben gerim," If a person's parents converted, lo yomar lo schom asav atecha, you shouldn't tell them, hey, remember what your parents did? Because that's not nice. A person doesn't want that to be mentioned. So now the Gemara goes into the applications of this. I'm going to skip some of this. There's one very important line here. If a person was suffering, he's ill, or terrible things are happening to him, if a person has disease that's attacking him, or a person was losing his children, don't tell him like Job's friend said to him, come on, you're foolish, you've never been as good as you think you've been, you obviously deserve it, because no one suffers if they don't deserve it. So that might be a correct philosophy, but it's not correct to say to the next guy. So part of the prohibition of not afflicting someone is that we're not supposed to tell someone that. Yes?
I may have misunderstood, but I remember you talked about at a different point. You were saying that there's that back and forth through most of the story because it's talking about what was not, that idea was not correct.
Right. But I'm saying sometimes that idea is correct. You know, if a person's gauging himself, so if bad things happen to a person is supposed to think, hey, where do I have to do tshuva? If the people of Israel are suffering a bombardment of missiles now, so then we have to think, wait, maybe we have to change something in our behavior. That's a correct approach vis-a-vis a person's self, but that doesn't give someone else the right to tell them that. You know, you're being a God-fearing person was obviously foolish, and you've never being as whole as you thought you've been, because no one suffers if they don't deserve it. That's the line they tell him. So that's very important, because sometimes people think they're doing the guy a favor when they tell him that line. You know, obviously God has his calculations, but that doesn't mean I should tell the person a line like that. Im yu chamrim vakshin tva mimenu, sometimes someone's coming and badgering you and you say so and so has it for sale, and you know he doesn't have it for sale, he doesn't sell that item at all. You shouldn't look at something as though you're going to buy it when you don't have money in your pocket. Now these are things which no one knows what you're really thinking. No one knows if you can afford it or can't afford it. If you walked into the store to enjoy the air conditioning on a hot day and you're looking around as though you're interested when, in fact, you're not interested in a thing. So all that is this prohibition. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan quotes Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Gdol onat varim me'onat mamon. When it comes to afflicting someone with one's words, saying something hurtful is more weighty than actually doing something unfair in business. You see, with regards to onat varim, with regards to afflicting someone verbally, the Torah reiterates, v'yareta me'elokecha, have fear of Hashem. It's adding a warning. Rabbi Elazar, whenever we encounter Rabbi Elazar in the Gemara, Rabbi Elazar is Rabbi Elazar ben Pidas, the disciple of Rabbi Yochanan, he says, ze begufo v'ze b'mamono. When we say something hurtful, we hurt the person personally. When we do something that's unfair in business, we've hurt his money. Hurting a person personally has more gravity. Rav Shmuel bar Nachmani adds, "Zenitan lehi shavon." When you took something, you took an exorbitant price on something, you can give the money back. "Zelo nitan lehi shavon." But when something hurtful was said, you can't ever give it back. You can't replace that. They quoted in front of Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak, Kol ha-malbinin t'nei chavero b'rabim ki'ilu shofech damim. He who embarrasses someone publicly, it's as though he killed him. He answered them, he said to them, Shapir kamrit. He says, yeah, you're right. T'chazina le'dazis sum kamati chivra. You see a person goes red and then he loses his color. So that's a sign, it's as though you killed him. Abaye said to Rav Dimi, what are they so careful in the West, in Israel? So he said to him, the achvare ape, they're careful not to cause someone to go white, not to embarrass someone. Because Rav Yochanan said, everyone ends up in perdition, except for three. What do you mean everyone's going down to perdition? It means everyone who goes down to perdition gets out of perdition, except for three. They go down, they don't come back up. Who are the three that go down and don't come back up? That's a person who commits adultery. He's intimate with a married woman. A person who gives his friend a nickname that's an embarrassment. He gives him a nickname that's hurtful to the person. And a person who shames his friend publicly. So the Gemara says, aren't those last two the same? By giving him a nickname that embarrasses him, so that's shaming him publicly. The Gemara says, no, what we came to add was, even if a person is already used to that nickname, and then this person calls him that nickname, but his intention is to embarrass him again. So the guy doesn't turn white because he's used to it. Everyone calls him that name. But when he's called that name again by someone who intends to hurt his feelings in heaven, they count that against him. Rav Yochanan is quoted as having said, a person should rather do even questionable act rather than embarrass someone else. How so? He quotes a pasuk about King David. David said they used to embarrass him publicly. He'd walk into the academy. They were busy learning the laws of tents, when a corpse defiles a whole tent, when a blemish causes a person to be tame. David would walk into the academy. They're learning an entirely different topic, and they'd ask him, oh, David, so good you came. Tell us, when a man sleeps with a married woman, what death penalty does he get? So they were obviously trying to embarrass him over the story of Bathsheba, that it wasn't so clear if when he was with Bathsheba she was married or single. There was definitely room to look at that as him having done that. So they ask him, you know, if someone sleeps with a married woman, what death penalty does he get? And it was clearly off topic. They were discussing something else. It was a clear attempt to shame him. And David would answer them and say, well, that person would get the death penalty of chenek, strangulation. But you know what? After he dies, he has a portion in the world to come. But if someone shames someone else publicly, that person will not have a portion in the world to come. So that was David's answer to them, and this is one of the sources we have for this idea. Okay, next story. Rav Yochanan quotes in the name of Rashbi, a person should rather throw himself into a furnace and not shame his friend publicly. How do we know this? You guys should all know this. From Tamar. Tamar was being taken out to be executed, and she sends word to her father-in-law, and she says, the guy who owns these, he fathered these children. She didn't just say, hey, it's you. She wouldn't embarrass Yehuda publicly. So from there we learn that. Okay, now we have a quote. Amar Rav. And this quote is quoted in Shulchan Aruch. Seems like part of this Agadic part of Talmud. This line is actually quoted in Shulchan Aruch. Lo'olam yehe yadam zahir bo'na'at ishto. A person should always be careful not to say something that'll hurt his wife's feelings. Shemitoch shedimata metzuya, being that she tears easily, onata kerova. So then that means that in heaven they give greater weight to her pain, and if her feelings are hurt, so then God is quicker to punish a person over it, because she's actually shed a tear. Shedding a tear carries a greater weight. Rabbi Elazar taught, from the days the destruction was temple, the gates of prayer were locked, but the gates of tears were not locked. So that's why if a woman sheds a tear because her feelings are hurt, that carries more weight. Yes?
Are the gates of tears in the sense that, I mean, babies also cry a lot, but you know, you're not going to, you know, go to perdition because you didn't get a father.
Right. See if you can figure that one out yourself. Think about it.
Okay.
Think. Rav Papa, who was Rava's disciple, he said to Abaye, people say if your wife's short, bend down and whisper to her. So that's an important line. If your wife's little, bend down and whisper to her. What does that mean? That means that sometimes people say, what does she understand? What does she know about business? What does she know about science? Whatever field he's in, sometimes he can feel like she doesn't understand that. And Chazal quote this saying, that what this saying is teaching us, that an intelligent person ensures that his wife is in on the deal. He doesn't say she doesn't get it. He says, well, let me explain it to her. Ah, you might have to bend down to explain it to her, so bend down. But make sure you get her input. So the Gemara says, you have to know that it depends on whether you're talking about things of the world to come or things of this world. Anything that pertains to this world, you better listen to her. Anything that pertains to the world to come, spiritual matters, that's where you have to set the tone in the house. You have a responsibility there. You learn, understand, and set a positive tone in the house. So this line in Gemara led to many famous conversations. Identical stories. There's a story about, maybe it was Rav Elchanan Wasserman, I don't remember, one of the rabbis of the previous generation, who said that when he and his wife were getting engaged, they made a deal based on this Gemara. Every issue that pertains to this world, she'll decide. Any issue that pertains to the world to come, he will decide. And they spent the next 50 years discussing how you delineate that. Because what you have for supper can be viewed as something that pertains to this world. Or else, well, depending on how you digest it, will depend on how much koch you have the next morning. When you're, the more spiritual a person is, the more everything pertains to the world to come. It's all a question of, will I have more money to buy better esrog, or will I have more money to buy more steak? So you could view everything as pertaining to the world to come and everything as pertaining to this world. There's a similar story about the Rosh Yeshiva and the CEO of the Yeshiva, where they made the same deal and then they ended up having the same conversation for 50 years. Who decides what you serve for lunch? Does that pertain to this world or the world to come, the food that you give the Yeshiva guys? You could view it both ways. Rav Chista gives us the quote, which now opens up all these stories. All the gates can be locked aside from the gate of affliction. When a person is hurt, so then his cry pierces the heavens and that gate cannot be closed. And from here, the Gemara starts giving us quotes. Beforehand, the Gemara gives us a few more important tips. Rav Yehuda says, a person should always be careful to have enough food in the house. Because the prime cause for fights in a house is when there's a shortage of food. That's why I tell people sometimes you have to be intelligent in how you manage your budget. It's not just a question of managing the budget. Sometimes it's a question of ensuring that your spouse feels like the budget is balanced. Sometimes a spouse can get very uptight if they see the balance is at 20 shekel. You know that money's coming in tomorrow, the next day, your salary's coming in, other things are coming in, but your spouse sees the balance is at 20 shekel and she gets uptight. So sometimes you have to think about how to manage that budget. Sometimes it pays to say we will maintain a cushion of 2,000 shekel that we don't touch. From our perspective, 2,000 is zero. Right? And that way you can always, that can lend a certain atmosphere in the house if you can work it out that way. I'm saying once you know this Gemara, that a prime cause of strife in the house is a shortage of food, that feeling that there's a shortage of food, so then you have to think how to use that information wisely. The Gemara says a person should always be careful in honoring his wife, because the only reason a person has blessing in his home is because of his wife. Even by Avram it says, Ulavram etiv bavura. Because of Sarah, Avram had it good. So depending on how you treat your wife will define what kind of life you lead. And that's what Rava used to tell the people. Cherish your wives, beautify your wives. That'll make you wealthy. Okay, and that brings us to the stories here. You guys wanted to know about Reish Lakish. We'll get there. First, there's another story. The Talmud tells us the story of Tanur Shel Achnai. You guys all know the story of Tanur Shel Achnai? The story of Rabbi Eliezer that was ostracized over the oven. Do we all know that story? Can I skip it? Yes?
That's too long.
You know the story? You know the story? Binny, you know the story? No. Okay, in a nutshell. If you have an oven, an earthenware oven that's attached to the ground, a tanur is an oven that's built like a teepee. It's broad on bottom, thin on top, has one hole and a broad section on bottom for a lot of wood. So tanur provides a lot of heat. And they would generally bake pita bread on a tanur. So if a person has a tanur, the Torah says a tanur, this type of oven, can become defiled. Okay, what do? You tats. The Torah says smash it. So our tradition is that you don't have to literally smash it. What you could do is cut it. So even though it was made of earthenware, they had a way of slicing earthenware. So imagine if you have this triangular shape and you cut off, you cut it. So then you could always use the bigger half as a new oven. So the Mishnah says you have to take the bigger half and cut that in two. So you end up turning it into thirds. Now what would happen if you'd glue it back together again? So then it would get defiled again. The old defilement comes back to this tanur. So you have a tanur that became defiled. One of the eight vermin went inside and died inside. So, or it was in a tent of a dead body. So you break it in half and you break the bigger half in half. Now if you'd glue it back together again, we said all the defilement would come back. So they wanted to do a new thing. They said, let's take it, and we have the three, we have thirds, right? What would happen if we would put sand in between and then glue it? So you're not re-gluing it, it's not back to its old self, because you have sand in between each layer, right? You have a layer of oven, sand, another layer of oven, sand, and another layer of the oven. And then you put tar or pitch or glue or whatever it is to cement it back together again. Does that go back to its old state? Do we say about that that it also gets defiled again? So Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus said it's pure. The sages said it's defiled. And that's what's called tanur shel achnai, the oven that looks like a snake, like it's coiled around itself. So Rabbi Eliezer gives them all the arguments in the world, and they're not willing to listen to him. And he says, guys, I'm telling you, and haven't they agree with me, if I'm right, then this carob tree will prove it. And the carob tree gets up and shifts 100 footsteps away. They said, that's not a proof. He said, if I'm right, so then the stream will prove it. And the stream started flowing backwards. So they said, that's not a proof. So he said, if I'm right, then the walls of the academy will prove it. And the walls of the academy started caving in. Rabbi Yoshua yelled at them and said, if the rabbis are arguing, what's it your business? So the walls wouldn't straighten out, because out of respect for Rabbi Eliezer, and they wouldn't come crashing down out of respect for Rabbi Yoshua. So the Talmud says, till today, in the days of the Talmud, you could go see that academy and see the walls bent over. So Rabbi Eliezer said, if I'm right, then heavens will prove it. And a heavenly voice comes out and said, why are you guys arguing with Rabbi Eliezer? He's always right. So Rabbi Yeshua stood up on his feet and said, but the Torah is not in heaven. You gave us the Torah, and you told us as rabbis that we have to interpret it using the best of our ability. That's what we're doing. So then we can't take into account a voice that comes out of heaven. Our logic says it's this. We have to go with that. You gave us a rule. Go by the majority opinion. So the Talmud says Rabbi Natan met Eliyahu HaNavi and he asked him, you know, when that happened, what did they say in heaven? Because they didn't answer Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Yoshua speaks to heaven and heaven doesn't answer back. So what was heaven saying then? So Eliyahu says, God was happy and said, my children won, my children won. So the heavenly voice said, what are you arguing with Rabbi Eliezer? He's always right. They brought in every item that Rabbi Eliezer said was tahor and burnt it. And they said it's not tahor, because that's the way the courts ruled below. And they ostracized Rabbi Eliezer. And from that moment onward, we don't rule like Rabbi Eliezer. And almost all of Shas, it's one of the most phenomenal things, the heavenly voice said Rabbi Eliezer's always right. And we will almost never rule like Rabbi Eliezer. The halacha is Rabbi Eliezer shamutihu. Rabbi Eliezer was put into ostracism, And as such, almost anywhere you encounter Rabbi Eliezer in the Mishnah, the halacha is not like him. That's the power of the power that Hashem gave the rabbis. So, at the end of his days, so here it says that Rabbi Eliezer's wife was the sister of the prince, Rabban Gamliel. And actually, Rabban Gamliel had done something that was hurtful to Rabbi Eliezer. So, any time... So the first thing is, when Rabbi Eliezer heard that they put him into ostracization, so Rabbi Gamliel was out at sea at that moment, and the sea went wild. And Rabbi Gamliel stood up and he said, I know this is because of Rabbi Eliezer. He says, Master of the world, you know it is revealed before you that I didn't do this for my honor or my father's honor. I didn't do it for the family honor. I did it for your honor because we have to come to halachic ruling according to the way you taught us. And if one person gets away with bringing all kinds of far out proofs, then there'll always be arguments in Israel. There has to be a bottom line based on the majority opinion. So the waves calmed down. Rabbi Eliezer's wife was Rabbi Gamliel's sister, and from that day onward, anytime Rabbi Eliezer would finish Shmoneh Esrei, she'd always disturb him. So he wouldn't go from Shmoneh Esrei down to Tachnun. There'd always be a break. And one time, she thought it was 2 days Rosh Chodesh, when in fact it was only 1 day Rosh Chodesh, so she didn't realize that that morning at the crack of dawn, Rabbi Eliezer would finish his Shmoneh Esrei and then do Tachanun. She thought that day was also Rosh Chodesh. Suddenly she realized that, hey, no, I got the calculation wrong. Today's not Rosh Chodesh. So she ran to the room where he was davening, because she'd always find some sort of excuse and say, Rabbi Eliezer, could you help me take this down? Or some kind of excuse to distract him. And that day she didn't. And she ran into the room and he's saying Tachanun straight after Shmoneh Esrei. And she runs in and she says, get up, you're killing my brother. And by the time he got up from his Tachanun, they had blown trumpets, which was a sign that the Nasi had died. The day he put his head down in Tachanun, Rabbi Gamliel drops dead. So he turns to her and says, how'd you know that would happen? So she says, I have a tradition from David, from my father's father's father, which she almost always means from King David, that all gates get closed aside from the gate of affliction. The courts might have ruled right, but they hurt your feelings. And in heaven, when a person's hurt, that carries weight. Even if the halacha was with Rabban Gamliel and everyone else. So if he was able to go into Tachanun, what do we say in Tachanun? Hashem, Rabul Tzarai, Hashem, I'm suffering so much. Rabim, Kamim Alai, right? So many people are turning against me. If you could go straight into Tachanun from Shmoneh Esrei without distraction, nothing can stand in the way of that prayer. And that's where Rabban Gamliel died. So that's the story over here in the Talmud. I thought the story of Reish Lakish is here, that's why we did all of this, and it's not here. So I have to remember. Okay, but I don't remember where's the story of Reish Lakish. Give me a second, I thought it was here. I went to all this to get you the story of Reish Lakish.
Do we all know the story?
No, we don't all know the story. Where is it?
Everybody dies.
Right, that part we discussed. Okay, I'll tell you the rest of the story, and I don't remember where it is right now.
Literally, everybody dies.
Right.
So okay, so you guys all know it. Okay, so you and I will have to do one-on-one. I'll tell you the story different time. Back to our Gemara. So we're dealing with Reish Lakish. I'm a Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish to it. My dichtiv. What does the verse mean when it says in Isaiah, "Vayam munatitecha chosn yeshuot chokhmat vadat"? The truth, the faith of your period will be a strength of salvation, wisdom and knowledge. What's it talking about? So we have a tradition that this verse is an allusion to the six orders of Mishnah. Emunat, when we speak about faith, that's called Zroim, the order of the laws of planting and the mitzvahs of giving charity, Truma, Meiser, Shemitah, Peah, all the laws of tithing and planting and not crossbreeding, right? And the firstborn, the first fruits. So that's called Emunat because you need faith. You have a crop, you think I need all of that, and suddenly comes the Torah and says, take off 20% and give it away. That's not easy. That's a high amount of taxes. So for that, you need a certain amount of faith. That's why the order of Zraim, of seeds, is called Emunah. Itecha, your periods, so that's obviously talking about Moed, the holidays, the different periods of celebration. Chosen, your strength, that's talking about a wife. That's your strength. That's very interesting, that Chosen, a person's strength, is a person's wife. So Rashi gives an interpretation that strength really means a continuation, having inheritors, and that comes from a wife. Yeshuot, salvation, that's Nezikin. That's the order of damages, because what's happening here is we're being warned not to harm someone else. So that's the Yeshua. It's saving a person from losing his money. Chochmat, wisdom, is kachim, the order of the holiness, the different order, the different laws of the sacrifices. Da'at is ta'ot, knowledge is on a higher level. That's talking about the order of the laws of purity. That's such depth. And at the end of all that, it says Yirat Hashem Yotzaro, God's chosen thing, God's storage houses are filled with the fear, the awe of God. You want to know, after all the things you've learned all of Shas, you should still know that the goal of everything should lead up to the prime thing, which is being a God-fearing person. And that's going to lead us into the discussion of what happens after a person passes away. The questions they ask a person, were you honest in your dealings? Did you set time to learn Torah? Did you deal in building a family, having children? All this order of life, these six orders of Shas are a description of six aspects of life that a person is going to be interviewed at the end of his life. They're going to ask him, hey, did you live up to this? This isn't theoretical, it's practical, it's an applied science. So that's the next discussion we'll pick up with, God willing, the beginning of next semester. Next Monday night is already Tisha B'Av. So we'll continue here, Bezrat Hashem, next semester.